Welcome to Solutions for the Underaffiliated, the show for people who want positivity, hope, and examples of improving the overall health of humanity. I'm DJ EJ. We're talking today with Kip Sullivan, who is an author, lawyer, and advocate for Medicare for All. He's headquartered in Twin Cities area in Minnesota, and he's just spent a career organizing and advocating for universal health care. So we're going to talk to him in just a second. Remember to check out all of our podcasts of the show and blog at underaffiliated.com and stream Asheville FM live from the site or the app. Good morning, Kip. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got here, and then we can talk some more about some of the big issues of today. I think it's going to be a meaty show.
Well, my formal training is law. I got a law degree, worked for 3 years in the South Bronx, representing kids under 16 with the New York Legal Aid Society. Got very frustrated watching these poor kids come in at the end of the meat grinder, and fell in love with community organizing. Went back to Minnesota, where I grew up, and joined an organization called Minnesota Citizens Organizing, Organizations Acting Together. About that time, the farm crisis was driving farmers out of business, and soon to be Senator Paul Wellstone, was organizing with people that were interested in having farm foreclosures. And my organization got involved, and this was the early 80s. And we discovered that one of the first things families do when they're under stress is to drop their health insurance or to buy health insurance with enormous deductibles. And this was before the healthcare crisis was a household word. So my organization began to investigate the reasons for high healthcare costs early on. And by the late 80s, when the healthcare crisis did become a political issue and a headline issue, we already had a head start on it. I was assigned the task of leading a campaign here in Minnesota for a state universal health insurance system. And we soon joined forces with groups around the country seeking to create a national health insurance system, which we soon, by the late 80s, were calling Medicare for All. So my law degree didn't help me a whole lot. I've never looked back. I thoroughly have enjoyed working for universal health insurance for all of Minnesotans, for all Americans.
You're on a show in Asheville, North Carolina. I asked you to be on here. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that I think your experience in Minnesota with Medicare for All has lessons that we could learn, not just in North Carolina, but around the country. So what are some of the things that you would recommend listeners think about from the standpoint of starting in Minnesota and even, transferring to other states?
Well, the principles that I want to talk about apply both to the national level and Minnesota. The legislation that we're supporting at the national level, Representative Pramila Jayapal in Washington and Bernie Sanders from Vermont, have introduced Medicare for All legislation that we support. I helped write Medicare for All legislation here in Minnesota. The arguments for Medicare for All at the state and national level are identical. For those who are thinking about now, well, how do I decide what kind of a solution I want to support? I suggest you do this. You first have to figure out, why are U.S. healthcare costs so high? And you basically have two choices: total spending in any sector of the economy, be it bananas or healthcare, is a function of two numbers, price times quantity. The number of bananas sold in a year times the price gives you total spending on bananas. And if you're worried about total spending on bananas, the first thing you got to do is ask yourself, well, which is the more serious, is contributing more to the problem, the price of bananas or the quantity sold? Well, to come back to healthcare, the wizards that have controlled health policy, the debate at the national and state level, have persuaded state legislatures and Congress that the main problem is quantity, the quantity number, and they've ignored the price number. And so they have sold legislators and members of Congress and much of academia on this idea that the reason U.S. healthcare costs are high is that patients get too much healthcare. The average American simply doesn't buy that, because most of us understand that we're not eager to get chemotherapy we don't need. We're not eager to have heart surgery we don't need. We're not eager to take drugs we don't need. But that's the prevailing diagnosis, is that we Americans get too much health care. And so the first thing you got to ask yourself is, where is the evidence for that? Because if the diagnosis is wrong, the solution that is typically follows from that diagnosis is probably wrong. And in this case, that's what happened. The solution, this is the second thing I'd suggest you look at, has been, let's give insurance companies the authority to interfere in the doctor-patient relationship. So to take an example, many listeners may be aware of, nowadays, insurance companies will second guess a doctor's decision to hospitalize a patient. That didn't used to be the case. Now it is. It's called utilization review. So you've got to get the diagnosis right and then the prescription. And the third thing I would ask people to think about is the rapid consolidation of the system. In the last 50 years, we've gone from a system of small clinics and hospitals, numerous drug manufacturers, equipment manufacturers, to a system increasingly dominated by a few huge insurance companies, a few huge hospital clinic chains, and recently enormous companies like Amazon buying up hospitals and clinics. So you got to get the right diagnosis, think about the right solution once you get the right diagnosis, and think about how we unravel the consolidation that has occurred in this system over the last 50 years.
Let's go back for a minute just to the pocketbook issue of medical bills and debt and things like that. And your point is, folks, it's not how much you use, it's the price of what you use. I think we're all familiar with the price of drugs, and there's a lot of concern about corporate lobbying and drug prices and things like that. Tell us a little bit about how prices are set and whether you think they're inflated and how you think they're being inflated.
Well, all societies have two choices when the issue in front of you is, how do we control the price or whatever you want to talk about? One is you control it as consumers. And in that case, competition between, let's say, restaurants that sell pancakes. The competition will keep the price reasonable. There's no need to have a national bureau regulate the price of pancakes because competition does that. The other option societies have to control prices is regulation. In this case, we as voters are regulating the price through our elected officials, not consumers through competition. Neither competition nor regulation effectively regulates the price of anything in the healthcare system in America. And that makes us an outlier. No other wealthy country allows that to happen. To take the example that probably irritates most people, the high cost of health insurance, in this case, the high price, the high premium we pay, is driven mainly by two problems. The complete absence of regulation. I shouldn't say that. The absence of effective regulation, coupled with rising administrative costs. We can talk about that because it's an important reason why U.S. costs are so high. The cost of administering this very complex system drives up the price of everything.
So let's pause for a second.
And consolidation.
So let's just pause for a second and break something out. There's, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's two parts of the cost of the price of the premium equation. One is the cost of goods, which is the medical care itself. And the other part is the administrative expense associated with managing that. Do you have any idea what the, just to give folks an idea, on a percentage basis of those two, administrative costs and the cost of care, what the percentages of that total cost, the administrative costs are, just to give people a sense of how much it's impacting premiums and deductibles?
At the national level, the number is 30 to 35% of our total healthcare bill is spent on administration.
And what goes into administration? So help people understand, like, what is that?
And it falls into two large categories: administrative costs incurred by insurance companies and by government programs like Medicare and Medicaid that also incur their own administrative costs in the course of covering people. And then the entire rest of the medical sector, mainly providers, hospitals, and clinics. That 30 to 35% is roughly half and half, roughly half of it incurred by the insurance sector and the other half by the provider sector. Drug companies also incur enormous administrative costs. That's a starting point. Now, if you were to ask, if let's look at Medicare, for example, the traditional Medicare program, however, only spends about 2% of all the money it takes in on administering Medicare and pays out 98 cents to doctors and hospitals. The typical health insurance company, on the other hand, blows 20 cents of the premium dollar on administration. And let me just give you a couple of categories. Profit is a big one. Telling doctors how to practice medicine, doing the utilization review, arguing with the doctor as to whether they can be on this statin or that statin, whether the patient can be in the hospital or not. Constructing networks of hospitals and doctors that then within which the enrollee must stay. There was a time when nobody told you you had to go to this or that doctor. Now the insurance companies tell you that, and it costs them money to construct these networks every single year. Lobbying is another administrative expense that insurance companies incur that Medicare does not incur.
So, Kip, why are they building these enormous administrative labyrinths? Because it would seem like you would say, we're adding costs to our own business to make a profit, and you wouldn't want to build all that excess administration. So why are they doing it in the first place?
Well, and the last item I was going to mention was marketing, okay. Advertising. Some of these are just inevitable. If you're in any business, you need to incur advertising costs. To explain why it is they build networks, I'd have to give you some history of how it is that we went back in the 70s from insurance companies that did not try to limit your choice of doctor and hospital to insurance companies that now feel they must or they will go bankrupt. They feel like they've got to tell doctors how to practice medicine because all the rest of them do it. And it's like an arms race. Nobody can tell Russia and the United States to stop building ballistic missiles. And similarly, our thumb-sucking Congress and state legislators stand around while the insurance industry went, all of them adopted this tactic of telling doctors how to practice medicine, telling them what drug patients can have, when they can be in a hospital. And no insurance company felt like they could not do that because all the insurance companies that did not do that fast enough went out of business. So it's essentially a laissez-faire atmosphere that allowed the bad cost containment tactics to drive out the good.
A theme I'm hearing, Kip, is managing care, playing the role of doctor. And whether it's an insurance company or whether it's a consolidated health system, it's not a doctor coming in to treat the patient. That autonomy is missing. If that's correct, what's driving that and who's driving it?
Excellent question. The notion that doctors need to be supervised emerged in the early 70s. The early 70s is the first time that the United States witnessed healthcare inflation of a magnitude we'd never seen before. And it quickly became a political issue. And Congress was persuaded by a man named Paul Elwood that the reason U.S. healthcare costs were now suddenly rising was the doctors were ordering services patients didn't need. Here we come again back to that false diagnosis. This is where it began. And it's not an exaggeration to say that this one man, Dr. Paul Elwood, managed to wangle a meeting with Nixon officials in February 1970, where he said, you guys need a solution to healthcare inflation. And here it is. You need to encourage a newfangled form of health insurance company that will tell doctors, that will second guess doctors and reduce all this alleged overuse. And Nixon's guys bought it. And then the Democrats who controlled Congress at that time, they bought it. And the result was that in 1972, Congress inserted HMOs, health maintenance organizations, into Medicare. And in 1973, they passed the HMO Act of 1973 to subsidize the formation of the planet's first HMO industry. It happened almost overnight, this false diagnosis. So that's essentially where it has come from, this folklore that overuse is the main reason American costs are high. And the irony is that the endorsement of HMOs and the control of doctors by insurance companies aggravated two problems: rising administrative costs for both the insurer sector and the provider sector, and consolidation. And that in turn drove up price, which was the real problem to begin with.
If you were to pick three things that folks should be thinking about as problems with the healthcare system, what would they be? Three things that you think are people should be thinking about.
We need people to question anything that suggests that you or your doctor are the problem. And you will hear this overuse argument in several ways, low-value care, and you'll hear stories about insurance companies trying to interfere in the doctor-patient relationship. We have to convince state legislators and Congress that overuse is not the problem. Second thing we have to convince them is that because overuse is not the problem, the solution is not to put big corporations, whether it's a health insurance company, a hospital clinic chain, or Amazon, in charge of supervising doctors. And the third major issue we have to focus on is the increasing consolidation of the system. Ownership of hospitals and clinics and doctors and pharmaceutical manufacturers by an increasingly small group of very large corporations.
Kip, what I want to get to is when we talk about healthcare system consolidation and we talk about new entrants like Amazon or CVS into healthcare, and we talk about health insurance companies managing care, how are they driving up prices? Because it's not always obvious. And I know we talked about health insurance, so I'll do a quick recap. They're driving up prices because as they manage the care, it requires more effort on their part to do so, which drives up their administrative costs. Therefore, they pass that on to consumers in the forms of higher deductibles and higher premiums. Let's talk a little bit about the other side of the equation in healthcare system consolidation and how that affects prices.
It's the combined effect of no price controls at all in this country with rising consolidation. If we had something resembling competition amongst many smaller hospitals, for example, not big hospital clinic chains, or many smaller health insurance companies, or many smaller drug manufacturers, then the absence of any effort at the state or federal level to set limits on prices would matter less or perhaps not at all. But in fact, we have the worst of both worlds. We have essentially big cartels running all the major sectors of our economy. Nearly all major cities, two or three huge hospital clinic chains are your only choices. For many drugs, one or two drug companies are your only choices. In most states in this country, three insurance companies control 70 or 80% of the market. So we have the worst of both worlds. No competition to force these cartels to keep their prices down, and no regulation to do that.
A quick observation and a plug is that that's not really how capitalism is supposed to work. So what's interesting to me is that there's a lot of folks on the side of being against universal health care who say it's anti-capitalistic, it's socialism. But the other side of that is it's not capitalistic today. It's run by monopolies.
That's right. To the people who criticize Medicare for All as quote unquote socialism, and by the way, let's be clear what it means. We will socialize the insurance part of the industry. It doesn't mean that doctors are going to work for the government. The people who criticize Medicare for All as quote unquote socialism are sitting in the bleachers and whining and not telling us, well, then how many more decades are we going to wait for competition to kick in? As we sit here and wait and suck our thumbs in the bleachers, competition gets weaker and weaker and weaker, and the ability of the cartels to pass on their skyrocketing administrative costs and extract huge profits becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. So to the people that criticize Medicare for All, I say, please give us your solution. Don't come to us and expect us to accept that somehow because Medicare for All means the government becomes the single insurer. That is bad. That's how many countries are dealing with it now. That's what Medicare is. Medicare began as a single government payer insurer of a large sector of the American society, people over 65 and since 1972, disabled people.
Is it even possible to have more competition? One of the things that struck me was we talked about big insurance companies. We've talked about health system consolidation. And here in Asheville, we have one major player. And I think for folks who live in any city, what you said earlier is absolutely well known in that there aren't that many health systems. There aren't that many big clinics anymore. What's the impact of a giant company like CVS, who started off as a pharmacy company, and Amazon? What's their role in all this?
Well, what's scary is these large companies, particularly these gigantic companies that trade on Wall Street, what it means is that the decisions they're making that trickle down to patients are increasingly influenced by the desire to make a profit. We know that profit has to play a role in any successful, long-lasting business, and that would include, a one or two doctor clinic in a small town. We don't expect them to function at a loss. So profit is not a dirty word. The dirty word is excessive profit and control that is increasingly located miles and miles away from the examining room. That's what's scary about the takeover of healthcare by CVS and Amazon.
So help people understand that and just bring that home. I'm a patient. I go to see my doctor. How does what you just described and the influence these corporations have on my care impact me in that moment when I'm with my physician?
Well, to take an example of one I just heard, a patient with suspicious tumor, some kind of a symptom of cancer, was told by his doctor that he needed a MRI taken right away. But the insurance company stepped in and said, "We don't know if this symptom warrants an MRI." And it took them something like 5 or 6 weeks to decide, "Okay, yeah, you can have the MRI." Well, in the meantime, it turned out he did have a tumor and it had gotten bigger. Why on earth have we endorsed a system where somebody in a skyscraper, hundreds of miles away from the examining room, gets to second guess what a doctor and a patient think a particular symptom requires? That's a good example. And the problem is, you as the patient, you're sitting there waiting to hear from your doctor. You don't know what kind of pressure the doctor is under. You don't know anything about the corporation that is interfering, that is holding up the doctor's decision. And to come back to my previous remark, the accountability, your ability to hold your doctor and whoever is forcing him to delay the test is very limited when you're dealing with large corporations.
In that scenario, one argument could be, let's pretend I'm an insurance company and I get this request for this care. And I say, I'm not really worried about the utilization here. I'm worried about it being high priced. Is there something else this doctor can do that's less expensive? Now, I know that holds up care, but isn't that pushing back on the high price argument a little bit?
These decisions that I'm describing for you are not being made on price. Those issues get decided beforehand. The doctor would not even be in the insurance company's network if he had a history of sending patients to very expensive MRI clinics. That would have been dissolved. That a price issue hardly ever comes up at the very moment when the patient needs the MRI or the hospitalization.
So the prices are set when the contract is signed between the insurance company and whatever part of the health system is signing the contract.
Exactly. They negotiate. That's how you get in or out of a network. So if you're a hospital, a well-known hospital that treats particularly expensive patients, you will bargain with the insurance company, let's say in August of 2022, whether you will or won't be inside the network of the insurance company come January 2023.
So let's recap for a minute then how the health system sets those prices. What you're saying, it sounds like, is because there's no competition for the health system, they can pick a price. And then the insurance company can say, to what degree do we agree that we'll pay you for that price when we reimburse you for delivering the care?
That's close, but not quite right. Shortly after Congress endorsed HMOs and states started doing that, the HMOs seized a lot of market share from the traditional insurance companies. They did it, and the HMOs did it by signing contracts with doctors and hospitals or buying them. The traditional insurance companies realized we've got to act like HMOs. We've got to start buying our own doctors and hospitals and negotiating our own prices with them. The hospitals then realized these large insurance companies are coming to us and demanding enormous discounts. That in turn then triggered mergers amongst the hospitals. And increasingly, hospitals merged with each other and bought up clinics in order to come to the negotiating table with the big insurance companies with some negotiating clout. So what's a little more accurate to say is you can't say that any one hospital clinic chain picks its price and then sticks it to the insurance company. What we're watching is an arms race, largely between the insurers and the hospital clinic chains, where this victory goes to the largest. And this race to gigantism has been unchecked now for about 50 years. And the net effect is that everybody understands you need to get big. You want to get big in order to stick your customers with high prices, and you want to demand the lowest prices from whoever sells you labor or goods.
So one argument that you hear, or at least, you know, I think you hear from the insurance companies, and even I think a lot of healthcare providers, is that quality goes up because of all this management. Now we're doing the right thing. You're getting the best care at the right price, at the right time, and you'll be supremely satisfied. Do you have any evidence that that's true?
None. And the sad thing is that there was no evidence that it would be true when managed care was first sold to Congress and then to state legislatures. Managed care, by the way, is a phrase that emerged around 1985 to describe cost containment tools that were pioneered by HMOs. Utilization review, limiting choice of doctor, and exposing doctors and hospitals to financial incentives, something we haven't talked about yet. But those three tools, exposing doctors and hospitals to financial incentives, limiting patient choice of provider, and utilization review, second-guessing the doctor, they came to be called managed care by about 1985. There was no evidence that managed care would work before it was endorsed by Congress and spread. And as it spread, the evidence began to come in indicating not only it didn't work, but it often caused harm.
So do you think this is deliberate, or do you think it's a natural outcome of capitalism? You get insurance companies basically building out infrastructure to manage care and then being able to, you know, consolidate and drive up their premiums and increase deductibles and pass the costs on to consumers. So that's one way consumers pay. The other one would be with the high healthcare costs, whether it's drugs or whether it's payment for a surgery. Do you feel like this is an outcome of just profit? Because it doesn't sound like it's being passed on to consumers. Is it natural, or is it at some point sitting down and going, you know what? I know what the outcome is going to be. People are going to have to pay more, but it's more important for us to make a profit. Do you feel like it's a, and I'm not asking you to be cynical, but is it a deliberate, do people know what they're doing? And by people, I mean the people who run these organizations, are they aware that quality is not improving, but their margins are?
It's rare to see reporters function like a fly on the wall so they can overhear the actual conversations of people running health insurance companies these days. But on rare occasions, when they get sued, and as I think everybody knows, when lawsuits happen, there's a discovery process. We saw it happen with a Dominion suing Fox News and all kinds of embarrassing emails by Tucker Carlson. Some of those people were revealed. In some lawsuits against insurance companies for harm to patients, we're seeing evidence of really cynical, calloused top officials saying, yeah, we know this patient is going to suffer a lot if we don't authorize this drug or this treatment, but we're going to do it anyway. I have no reason to think that everybody along that entire chain of command thinks that callously. I think the safest thing to say is what's happened is that policymakers in this country have, with their laissez-faire attitude and their support for managed care, have created an environment that puts tremendous pressure on the managers of health insurance companies and hospital clinic chains to do the wrong thing. To do something, to when you've got a choice between doing something right for the patient or doing something right for the profitability of your enterprise, you opt to do something right for the profitability of your enterprise.
So one of the arguments you hear people make against Medicare for All or universal coverage, and maybe we should come up for a different name for it, is it doesn't give people choice. I can't choose my doctor, or I can't choose my insurance company. And it says to people, they're taking away some right you have. How would you reply to that and talk a little bit about whether or not you think in that process, consumers have a choice anyway?
My first response is that's just a lie. I don't know what else to say other than get the bill. Go look up Pramila Jayapal's Medicare for All bill. It's in the legislature now. I forget now the House number. See if you see anything that says patients will have to choose a network. That's not the case. Ask how does traditional Medicare work? Traditional Medicare does not limit your choice of doctor and hospital. Only if you sign up with the privatized portion of Medicare, its current name is Medicare Advantage, only if you enroll with Humana or United Healthcare or one of those Medicare Advantage insurance companies, is your Medicare coverage, your choice of providers under Medicare, limited. So just you got it right, Eric. It's a scare tactic. It's just an utter lie. There's no kernel of truth to it. And as you suggested, the problem is this is projection. It's the current system that limits your choice under a single-payer Medicare for All style system. And by the way, Medicare for All is increasingly a little misleading as more and more Medicare enrollees enroll with a Medicare Advantage plan. We may wind up changing the name because increasingly Medicare Advantage is taking over Medicare, and not because they're more efficient, but because Congress has stood by and overpaid these insurance companies for decades.
So how should consumers think about this debate that they're going to hear again, or maybe they'll hear again regarding Medicare for All? Because the conversation is going to come up, which is Medicare for All is socialism. Medicare for All is taking away your choices. You know, I think insurance companies are going to say, well, do you really want the government managing this? There's that, can the government do this job? There's just a whole host of finger pointing and saying the government can't do this. It's going to take away your rights. It's going to take away this. It's going to take away that. Build a little bit around the argument you would make against that.
I would urge people to look at Medicare, the original Medicare program. As I said earlier on the show, if you give Medicare a dollar's worth of taxes or what's called Part B premiums, Medicare keep the traditional Medicare program, not Medicare Advantage, but the traditional Medicare program where Medicare pays doctors and hospitals directly. It doesn't funnel tax dollars through Humana or United Healthcare. That's what the traditional Medicare program has done since it began operation in July 1966. Funk pays doctors and hospitals directly who treat Medicare beneficiaries. The traditional Medicare program will keep just 2 cents of the premium dollar to run its shop, to send out notices to people that it's time to sign up for Medicare, to process claims. 2 cents to run its shop for administrative costs, and pay out 98 cents to doctors and hospitals with no strings attached. I mean, no strings that would allow the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the agency that runs Medicare, to tell doctors how to practice medicine. The typical insurance company will keep 20 cents of every dollar. So the argument that somehow the government can't do anything right in the case of healthcare is flat wrong. The government has proven itself to be far more efficient than the private sector ever will be. And not only is the government more efficient, it is not limiting your choice of healthcare. I would urge people, if you have any doubt about whether a Medicare for All system is the best way to go, to just look at the traditional Medicare program, or ask somebody who is on traditional Medicare, has anybody in the traditional Medicare program ever had their MRI for cancer delayed by a bureaucrat in the government? No. So when you hear somebody say Medicare for All will give the government control over your doctor, you just need to know that is pure BS. It's a scare tactic. And what that is also doing is asking you to ignore the fact that Amazon and Humana and United Healthcare do control your doctor, do have immense influence over the decisions you and your doctor can make.
Is there a market solution to reducing prices? And by market solution, I mean, is there a way to increase competition so that prices go down?
No. And I don't know of any country that relies on competition to keep prices down. And if you were asking me this question back in 1970, before merger madness became an everyday event, I would still give you the same answer, because competition wasn't working well in 1970. Now that we're in a system where two or three hospital chains control virtually every market in America, and three insurance companies control three-fourths of every state's health insurance market, I see no hope at all that competition can be relied on.
There's a lot of talk around what's called an accountable care organization. And accountable care means holding physicians accountable for the care, holding patients accountable for their own care. Isn't that going to work?
Accountable care organizations emerged shortly after the end of the HMO backlash of the late 1990s. Americans just rebelled against the increasing control of their doctors by what were called HMOs, and then insurance companies that copied HMO tactics. But the advocates of managed care didn't give up. In 2006, a group called the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, an official body that advises Congress about all things having to do with Medicare and healthcare inflation, they endorsed this thing called the Accountable Care Organization. And essentially, they didn't say this, but essentially what they said was, it's going to be a much smaller HMO. And they gave no reason for anyone to believe that if HMOs couldn't work, why a much smaller version of an HMO would work. But in any event, MedPAC, as this commission is called, endorsed it in 2008 and 2009. And when Congress and the Obama administration were writing the Affordable Care Act in 2009, they said, what the heck? Let's stick ACOs into the traditional Medicare program. And so since 2012, we have seen four major ACO programs run by Medicare, and all have failed. We don't have as much evidence that ACOs are harming patients as we do with insurance companies that practice managed care tactics, because these ACOs are relatively new. But we do have some evidence that they are harming patients. We have no evidence that they're cutting costs. So it's the same problem. And why do we have ACOs? Now, you pop quiz. Tell me why you think MedPAC told Congress we need ACOs. Answer, because Medicare patients are overusing healthcare. That was the same old tired diagnosis, overuse. And ACOs will mimic HMO tactics at a smaller level. And lo and behold, we'll get these dang doctors to stop ordering services patients don't need. Wrong diagnosis, wrong solution.
So we've been using managed care for decades now, and it's not doing anything to improve quality or reduce prices. We've kind of talked about the fact that there's no real incentive to disaggregate this consolidation. There's no incentive for a large healthcare system to unbundle itself and break itself up. There's no incentive for the insurance companies to break themselves up and increase competition like there was. It requires regulation. Is that the only way, other than government policy? Is that why universal healthcare is the only option? Is because it's not going to happen naturally?
Well, let me be very clear. You could get to universal health insurance with the current system. If you can persuade Congress or your state legislature to raise taxes high enough to cover all the uninsured, we're at about 8 or 9% uninsured now at the national level. If you think that you and whoever you ally with can persuade your state legislature or Congress to raise taxes high enough to cover the remaining uninsured and cover the underinsured, good luck. You could get to universal health insurance that way. I am an advocate of universal coverage with a single payer system. And single payer simply means what the traditional Medicare program means. When it started out, the traditional Medicare program meant one payer, Medicare, reimbursed doctors and hospitals who treat Medicare eligible people. You don't funnel money through middlemen. The only option I see to getting to universal health insurance is through a single payer system, because now you cut out the enormous overhead, the enormous administrative costs that insurance companies incur on their own right, remember, 20 cents on the healthcare dollar, and that they force doctors and hospitals to incur because they meddle so much in the doctor and hospital business. To all of you thinking about doing something, and I encourage you to get into this issue, get into this debate. To all of you thinking about this, I ask you to think first about this. Do I think we can persuade Congress to insure all the uninsured and the underinsured if we don't bypass the insurance companies? Raising taxes that high, I submit, is probably not possible.
Well, let's talk about that, because right away, I'm just feeling people pushing back going, I have a trade-off to make. I can say my taxes are going to go up, or my healthcare prices and my healthcare system is not going to change and my prices are going to go up, but I don't always use the healthcare system. So how do I think about that trade-off of potentially higher taxes versus this risk or perceived risk of, you know, me or my family needing medical care and it being expensive?
Well, remember, the issue is not how often do you, you know, most healthy people are going to need healthcare of some sort at some point in their lives. But even if they miraculously stayed so healthy throughout their entire life that they don't need healthcare, you're paying huge premiums and taxes along the way. And this applies to people who are young and old. So, but you've said, you put it correctly, Eric, that what I'm asking people to is to think about that trade-off. Do you want to try to get universal health insurance without getting rid of the insurance industry and continue to pay the ransom that they demand we pay and suffer the consequences in the form of worsened health? Or do you think it's more politically feasible to say, all right, we know it's a heavy lift, but we're going to support universal coverage under Medicare for All, single payer. We know we infuriate the insurance industry. They will resist this tooth and nail because their fortune will depend upon it. That's the choice we face. And 30 years ago, I made the decision I'd rather infuriate the insurance industry and get a decent system rather than pay it lots of premium dollars and tax dollars to a bloated, inefficient, and increasingly harmful industry.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that folks would pay more today in deductibles and premiums and out-of-pocket expenses like copays or in taxes should we switch to a universal system?
You mean a single-payer system?
A single-payer system. So in other words, my option A is my tax bill goes up some amount, or you bring up a good point. Every month I get an amount out of my paycheck for my premium. If I go to the doctor, I have to pay a copay. If I have surgery, which I may or may not be able to afford, I have to pay it in full. Let's say it's something like $1,000, and that doesn't meet my deductible of $3,000, so I have to pay it. My child needs braces or, you know, some unaccustomed thing, but it's all under that deductible. If I add up those expenses, is that going to be the same as or equal to or more than my tax burden if we switch to universal care?
The studies indicate that if we switch to a single payer universal health insurance system, 95% of all Americans will see cuts in the amount of money they spend on health insurance and health care. The richest 5% will pay more because now we're going to be financing health insurance through taxes rather than premium payments, which, pardon the jargon, but are regressive. They tend to hit lower income. They tend to take a larger percentage of your income, the less income you have.
It's not as simple as you might think it is to just lobby for your congressperson, you know, send an email or make a phone call. How would you recommend folks act? Other organizations to join? I know you're in Minnesota for Medicare for All, but what can people do locally, wherever they are, to get involved and advocate for universal health care if that's what they want to advocate for?
I suggest that everybody check out Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP. They represent 25,000 doctors who really helped create the American single-payer movement. PNHP.org is their website. Lots of information. To find out if you've got an organization in your state that's working for universal health insurance through a single payer system, I would check out Healthcare Now. It's an organization that links up single payer organizations all over the country. And one last word of advice, whether you lobby on your own or with a group, and of course, I advise you work with an organization. It's going to make you more effective. I would say keep in mind that many of the legislators you're going to speak to either don't know much about this issue, or if they're on the key health committees, they have drunk the managed care Kool-Aid. I would urge you not to go in and just say to them, I want you to support this single-payer bill. That's better than nothing. But you got to go in and help them think through why their endorsement of managed care and insurance companies telling doctors how to practice medicine is wrong. And you might start with that the way I started out this show. If you're worried about total spending in any sector of the economy, you got to worry about price times quantity. You guys got it wrong when you endorsed quantity. The issue is price driven by consolidation of administrative costs. Start thinking through a very simple, elementary deprogramming presentation for your legislators. In addition to, I want you to support this particular bill.
Kip, we're going to have to go. And I really appreciate your time. And I think it was really, really informative. I hope this was simple. It's a very complex topic, but it was really helpful. So thank you very much. And thank you, everybody, for joining. And have a great day.